The Founding Fathers, American Revolution, our Constitution, our history, America. Thanks so much for tuning in as we discuss the people, places, events, and battles that turned 13 separate colonies into the greatest nation on earth, the United States.
Well, we hope that you enjoyed part one. Now let's pick it up and finish this amazing story about Henry Knox and the Knox Expedition with part two. So George Washington definitely liked, and he did have a lot of faith in Henry Knox, but let's be fair and realistic. George Washington really, really needed the cannons and artillery. So he approved of Knox's suggestion of retrieving the items. And I believe in reading what Knox and Washington wrote, Washington firmly believed that he could do this. How? I don't know, because it sounds pretty insurmountable to me. But so Knox and his team had to go to the Fort Ticonderoga, which was not an easy task to begin with. But they finally arrived at the fort on December 5th. And this expedition would also be called the Knox's Noble Train of Artillery. And there is a great book out there with that same title, and I highly recommend it. And I will put a link to it in my show notes, as I do for every timeline and bonus episode. Side note here, where did that term come from? Well, Knox wrote letters to George Washington during the expedition, and Henry Knox himself called it his Noble Train of Artillery. So that is where the name come from, or where the name came from. And why would he call it the Noble Train of Artillery? I think he and Washington and others knew that it was more than just bringing cannons. This was a very important piece to continuing the fight against Britain. And that's, I think, why he wrote that in a letter. Knox had oxen and horses, sleds, and some men to assist moving this massive amount of artillery. Keep in mind, this is without jacks, motors, or semi-trucks to assist. Just how could this much stuff be successfully moved back to Boston? Let's not forget, again, snow-covered, cold, freezing, rivers, lakes to cross, and there weren't any roads.
Well, for starters, Knox used his knowledge that came from speaking to soldiers in his bookstore. Remember, we talked about when he had his bookstore and the soldiers would come in and he would kind of grill them and get their viewpoints on how to do things. And he had such an interest in all of these subjects. So he had a good background in reading and speaking to people who had done things.
Yeah, I totally agree. He did learn a lot from talking to people, but his knowledge, just like Nathaniel Green's and many others, it came from the books. So kids, if you're listening out there, and adults, books are not a thing of the past. Books are critically important, and was in this case. That's where he got his education. The kid taught himself French. I could have three tutors and Duolingo and anything else out there, and I still would not know French. So as a young boy, reading so many books, he taught himself French. It's insane.
Knox and his men spent several weeks preparing the artillery for transport. They disassembled the cannons, removing the barrels from the carriages and wheels, and prepared sledges to haul the heavy loads over land.
That just sounds like a lot of work.
It is
just
a lot
that.
Of work.
Just disassembling, right? Cannons. It's crazy. But he did actually divide all the artillery into two main divisions. Each division was going to be pulled by teams of oxen. The first division, which was under his personal command, they left Ticonderoga on December 17th, 1775, and the second division followed just a few days later.
Knox chose a route that avoided major water crossings, as the ice was not yet thick enough to support the weight of the artillery. Instead, he followed the relatively level path of Lake George, the Hudson River, and overland through western Massachusetts.
No, wait, that makes it sound like he just went across the level way. And now, they had to cross the Hudson River four times. So It was either mud because it wasn't cold enough, or it was ice because it was cold enough, or it was partial ice and kind of a gamble, roll of the dice of, hey, should we put this 5,000-pound cannon on the ice? I mean, so he did pick the best route for sure. I agree with that, but it still wasn't easy.
Yeah, in fact, the entire trip took about 4 times longer than he anticipated at the outset.
Yeah, he thought it was going to take, 2 weeks. It took a lot longer. It's kind of like the previous Timeline episode with the March 2 and the Battle of Quebec. Benedict Arnold thought, I'll get up there in X amount of days, and it took him a lot longer. So the journey, needless to say, was very arduous. Climbing the Berkshire Mountains, which were covered with ice and snow, facing harsh winter conditions, rough terrain, and all the other logistical challenges. I can't even fathom what he had to deal with. But they did have to repair sledges, they had to build bridges, they had to navigate steep hills and valleys, and they didn't have chainsaws. And then, I don't know how they did it. And, I guess people do what they can with what they have, and they don't know the difference. But us today, looking back, it's quite impressive. I mean, if you're going to Google more or visit the links that I put in the show notes for this, they talk about all of this like we are. But what they don't mention is these guys had to sleep at some point. They had to eat at some point. They had to couldn't just lay out a blanket and hope for the best in a blizzard. They had to build shelter. So every single time they stopped, they had to do all this in addition to pulling 60 plus tons of artillery. It's just mind-boggling to me, because it's hard enough for me to imagine going up into the hills where I live in the winter and walking around it for, walking in it and around it for a few hours. But Knox and his team did this for almost 2 months. It's crazy. And let's not forget to mention that many had frostbite and many other injuries that hampered the men the entire trip. In fact, it got so bad with the frostbite that Knox actually had to get a wagon, and I don't have the exact number, but the wagon was full, and take them to a nearest town because so many people had frostbite. If you've never had frostbite, which I haven't, not a good thing to have, especially if you are stuck out in a winter wonderland.
Once they reached Albany, Knox then used sleds to move the artillery, with ox and horse pulling them, and needed to get back to Boston fast, or perhaps the war effort could be lost. They were already behind schedule, so they were kind of trying to get there as quick as they could with all the obstacles that they had. The men who were going to supply the animals didn't.
Of course not.
So obstacles like this happened a lot during this trip, but Knox overcame them. He secured animals and found solutions in order to continue. He was really determined to get this job done, and he did complete the task. So Knox and his team would accomplish this in 56 days, and during the entire trip, they only lost one cannon, although there were several times that they had broken through the ice and sank in different rivers and streams and lakes and whatnot. So they were able to recover all of them except for one, which is pretty amazing.
This made me wonder, okay, you have a 5,000 or 2,000 or 500-pound item, cannon, mortar, whatever. It goes through the ice and it goes to the bottom. I don't know how deep these rivers were. I don't know the lake depth. It doesn't matter if it's 5 feet or 500 feet, really, for me. But I wondered, how in the world would you get this item back up and on a sled and take with you? Well, did a little research, and he used pulleys and ropes. Before crossing over ice, each team of oxen and horse could quickly be removed from the artillery if it broke through. So he had two sets of rope, one on the item, the cannon, and one on the oxen. And so if it did break through, he would save the animals and retrieve the cannon later, because without the animals, you're not going to get this done. That was pretty smart for that reason, but that way it ensured that no men would be lost or be, sunk to the bottom of a river. We don't want that, and I'm sure he didn't. I don't remember seeing in all of our research any deaths that happened. I can't imagine there weren't, but nobody mentions it. So no loss of life to the men or animals was very important to him. So they would also use the pulleys that were connected to the cannon itself, and they would wrap them around trees nearby and get a whole bunch of men, and they would pull it out and raise it out of the icy water and put it back on the sleds. Just dumbfounding. Again, like, oh, look, we have a 5,000-pound cannon at the bottom of the river. Let's hook up this pulley. What? All right, it's time for another quick break from one of our sponsors.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
There are many books and details about these 56 days, which we won't go into here, but there are exceptional links in the show notes if you want to dive deeper and look into it further. If you choose to do so, you won't be disappointed.
We put a lot of time, energy, and effort to find these links that coincide with each show's topic. I don't really look at the stats too much. I know it's increasing quite a bit. But if you're not taking advantage of the show notes on a topic that does interest you, you're missing out. So I really highly encourage you to check them out. We do this on every episode. I also provide videos about this expedition, and so you can really immerse yourself with further knowledge, and everything is compiled for each show in the show notes, and it's nice and tidy and orderly for you. So
we try to especially look for primary sources in these kind of research that we do, because it's just very compelling to read those kind of things that people that were actually there and participating in it, you know, have to say about it. Yeah. So there was some really good primary sources, including for this episode, the diary that Knox kept during the trip.
Gold mine. Yeah. Totally gold mine.
I mean, you know, he didn't have anything else to do, so why not, you know, sit down and write in a journal every single night?
Right.
Actually, I guess there were some days that he skipped, and some were just super short entries. But given what he was doing and up against, the fact that he wrote anything down at all is impressive enough for me.
Yeah, I agree. In one entry, once reaching Albany, Knox wrote, "Went on the ice about 8 o'clock in the morning and proceeded so cautiously that before night we got over 3 sleds and were so lucky as to get the cannon out of the river. Owing to the assistance the good people of the city of Albany gave, in return for which we christened her the Albany." So here's an example of a cannon that went through the river, or broke through the ice, went to the river, got some help from the people that were living there, and once they got it out, he christened it the Albany. But I just think it's so cool to read what he wrote. And this is from his diary, and I do have a link to this. But Lisa, you want to read the second entry?
Sure. It says, "In the morning we got about 2 miles when our horses tired and refused to go any farther. I was then obliged to undertake a very fatiguing march of about 2 miles in snow, 3 feet deep through the woods, there being no beaten path. Got to Squire Fisher's, who politely gave me a fine breakfast and provided me with horses." It's these kind of details that really bring this kind of struggle to life, right? Can you imagine marching through 2 miles of snow, 3 feet deep? That's way too high.
Have you ever
I didn't have snowshoes.
Listeners, have you ever walked through 3 feet of snow? You could walk 50 yards, and unless you're really, really in shape, you're probably going to be sweating, out of breath, your heart's pounding. If it were me, I'd probably be throwing up. I mean, and here it is. Like, you know, I was fatigued, but I had to walk 2 miles. So, yeah, like Lisa said, it's these insights from the person himself or herself that really add to this story in this expedition. The last entry that I'm going to read, I think, is really special. Here they are in brutal conditions, tired, doing backbreaking work, difficult tasks every minute of the day that they're awake, and yet Knox had time in this entry to see his situation different. This was from January 5th, 1776. I went up the Mohawk River about 7 miles and there crossed over on very weak ice, indeed for horses, and run down alongside the river until we came to the falls, so famous in this part of the continent and known by the name of the Cohoose Falls. Those stupendous falls, inferior to none save the grand one of Niagara, are formed by the whole body of the Mohawk River falling at one pitch from a perpendicular 80 feet. It is the most superb and affecting sight I ever saw. The river is about 400 or 500 yards wide, and at the time I saw it, it was about 9 o'clock in the morning when the beams of the sun reflected on the whole icy scene. Vast icicles, 20 feet long and 3 or 4 feet thick, hanging, pendant from the neighboring rocks, which were formed from the rain and melted snow falling from the neighboring heights, and a very severe frost coming up, which arrested the water in its fall. This ornamented the scene in a very particular manner. The water falling from such height gave the water the look of milk. It looked like one vast torrent of milk pouring from a stupendous height. In its fall, occasioned a very thick mist to arise, which looked like a shower of rain, and I was told that in summertime, a perpetual rainbow was to be seen here. After having gazed and wondered for a long time, I returned to Albany about 12 miles from the admiring the stupendous works of nature, and not a little humbled by thoughts of my own insignificancy. That's beautiful to me. I mean, your thoughts on that?
To be going through such a grueling hardship, you know, working so hard to get that back for such an important cause, and he takes the time to just reflect on the beauty that he's seeing in this frozen water and the falls coming over the side of the mountain, and, you know, just to be able to pause and look at something like that and be humbled by it. I don't know, that's just really cool.
Yeah, it is. I hope that you found that entry as powerful as I did, and as Lisa mentioned about the diary, I have a link to his actual diary that you can flip through digitally. It's pretty special to be able to see this journey in his actual diary, in his own handwriting, and read what he wrote. For me, at least, it brings it even more to life and makes it more real, I guess, putting me in their shoes. And thankfully, it's just mentally, because physically, I would not be able to do that. I don't think I'd be able to do what they've done, but I agree that that passage alone is phenomenal. And the link to his diary, it's really cool. You get to see his handwriting, which is sometimes hard to read. A couple pages are faded, but you can transcribe it and look at it and read it in print form. So it's pretty cool. So,
whew, we're getting close to getting back to Boston.
Yeah, but before we get into what happened after they arrived in Cambridge and met up with George Washington, I want to relay that something like that had never been done in history, and Lisa had mentioned that, but this was backbreaking, difficult, full of obstacles, crazy weather, brutal conditions, frostbite, and truly, quote, impossible. For that matter, this trip was considered by most, even the higher-ups at the time, not George Washington, a dangerous goal that likely would not be accomplished. Today, the Knox expedition is considered one of the most amazing and successful military accomplishments to date. One historian says it like this, quote, one of the most stupendous feats of logistics. I think that is even an understatement. And with everything going on physically and the trials that they had to overcome about the expedition, you also can't forget that the war, the revolution, and the future formation of the United States was all riding on Knox and his team accomplishing this task. How would you like that weight on your
shoulders? No pressure.
Because without artillery, it very likely would have been all over. And again, I don't want to sound melodramatic, but it's one of the most important points during the war that could have either made us or broke us. And as you know, we're a country now, so it obviously worked out. But nobody hardly knows about the expedition that Knox took. That's why we wanted to do it. And hope that you're learning a lot. Yeah, so we wanted to share the life of Henry Knox, but this expedition ranks right up there with probably Valley Forge. because that's when the army really started to become an army.
It was one of those really pivotal moments.
Yeah, huge. It was huge.
Of which there were a few, but this one, yeah, one of these really important defining moments. And like Ron said, it's unfortunate that more people aren't aware of Henry Knox and what he did to make that happen.
But you guys are now, and hopefully you share it with people. But all right, Lisa, so he makes it back. Washington now had artillery. What in the world are they going to do with it?
So now they have another impossible task ahead of them.
Oh, good. You got through that. So let's go ahead and figure out impossible task number two.
In case they didn't work hard enough. In the cover of darkness, they were needing to get the artillery all up to Dorchester Heights, which was a unsecured location above Boston that the British had not done anything about for some reason. But we knew that if, you know, Washington knew if they could get that artillery up there and surround the city, that they would have a chance of driving the British out of Boston. They had to go up and build fortifications and get all that artillery up there. So they had 50 plus cannons at the top of Dorchester Heights. The Heights was about 120 feet above sea level, or that of Boston. So as with most military engagements, the higher ground usually has the upper hand, so to speak.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, mental map. They had to get these cannons to the top of the highest point. One of the highest points surrounding Boston. And Dorchester Heights looks down on the port in Boston and also the city of Boston. So if you had artillery, you could blast any of the any of the British ships out there, and you could also bombard the city, which you wouldn't think you'd want to do, but it was all British soldiers who had overrun buildings and homes and businesses. So bombing the city and bombing some of the ships seemed like a pretty good idea at that point.
But let's not forget, they did it all in one night. So
one night.
That's a huge undertaking. They had to get all those cannons up the hill in the middle of the night, get them set up, get the fortifications built, get them pointed towards Boston and the Boston Harbor. And the following morning, the sun rises and the British are just waking up.
Yeah, they're just like, you know, stretching, putting their red coats on, and they look up and they're shocked. Not as shocked as when Knox opened fire and unleashed a bombardment of shells into Boston and the harbor. And one of the most famous quotes that you may have heard, General Howe of the British Army is quoted as saying, "My God, these fellows have done more work in one night than I could make my army do in 3 months." That's from the opposing top dog, folks. I mean, that's impressive. And they had to do it in the cover of darkness and during at night. And they had to be, how could you do that in one night? It's just one of those things that was pretty awesome. One thing I didn't mention in here is that Howe was going to stop them from taking the cannons up, but a snowstorm came in which halted that, which meant they were not only doing all of this work and moving the cannons up at night, they had to do it in a snowstorm. So the British ships that were there, they could not aim their cannons that high, so they couldn't even fire back if they wanted to. So all of the British were like fish in a barrel, and the new Continental Army was ready to decimate all ships and all British army located in Boston. They knew then, they being British, they had no choice. They had to leave, but they wanted to leave not in a scattered, scared way. So Howe sent a note to Washington, told Washington that if you allow us to leave without being fired upon, we're not going to burn Boston to the ground. So Washington agreed to this, and it was the first victory of the Revolution.
So on March 7th, Howe decided to evacuate the British troops from Boston. They called it Evacuation Day, and 11,000 British troops, nearly 1,000 loyalists, left the city. They had agreed, like Ron said, not to burn down the city, and they took their ships and they hightailed it out of there.
So, I mean, and that's a really good point that I didn't, you know, initially put in here that you found. So thank you for that. But we're not talking about we're going to get rid of 500 British soldiers. We're not going to get rid of 3,000 soldiers. 11,000 soldiers were there.
They completely abandoned the city.
That is exactly why it was so imperative and so important, and why having cannons above to get the British army out was so important, because there was 11,000 of them. So,
yeah. So the British set sail for Halifax, Nova Scotia on March 17th. I actually hadn't realized they went to Nova Scotia, but that's kind of interesting. So March 17th, and then that same day, Artemus Ward and 500 of his men came into Boston, and the next day, General Washington came in, and they moved into the city on March 20th. So another thing that I had come across that I didn't know previous to this was that the British had left around 69 of their own cannons behind. So in addition to all the artillery they brought down from Ticonderoga, they were also able to salvage some of these 69 cannons that the British left behind in Boston.
Yeah, and not only was it a great military victory, it really enhanced the mindset and the morale of the Continental Army, which was rather small. In fact, it boosted its numbers after this. So it was just a win-win-win when you look at it from the start. It's an impossible task, but he did it. And as you're going to soon hear in our lesser known fun fact section of the show, Knox was instrumental in countless battles, and without him, the war would have no doubt looked very different. And likely it may not have continued at all without his success of the Knox expedition. And what else about Knox would you like to share?
Well, he eventually became the Secretary of War when Washington was the president. And one of his tasks was working diligently to have good, amiable relationships with Native Americans.
Yeah, so there was a lot of movement of Native Americans. Washington wanted to have it peaceful. That's a whole nother podcast episode. But let's just say that tensions sometimes ran high, and it was Knox put to the task of mending and having good relationships with the Native Americans. And on January 2nd, 1795, Knox left the government, and he went home to Thomaston, Maine. And at this time, this city and area was still part of Massachusetts, but now it is actually in Maine.
One of the things that Knox did later in his life was he wanted to become a really big landowner. And so when he got up to Maine, he attempted to acquire as much land as possible, and he was pretty successful at that. However, in many cases, it caused some consternation among other people in the area. He kind of got unpopular with some people. One person that he took land from was Joseph Plum Martin. You may have heard that name. He had written one of the most read,
detailed diary
about his wartime experiences, and he was also involved in almost every major battle, so his knowledge and input was really important. But he was one of the people that, you know, Knox went up and was trying to take land from. So
yeah, I gazed over and I have his book. It's a short read and very interesting. I'll go ahead and put that link in the show notes as well. It's a really short read. He got so tired of being asked, what was it like to be at Yorktown? What was it like to be bombed and shot at? What was it that he said, I'm just going to write a book? And he did it when he was quite a bit older. So some people say he embellished, some people say he didn't. I think it's probably pretty accurate. I didn't find anything too crazy in what Joseph Plum Martin wrote. But now, let's be fair, too. Knox wasn't, I'm bigger, I was important in the war, I was the Secretary of War, I want your land. Joseph Plum Martin and the other people that he took to court owed him money. And since they couldn't pay, he said, I'll take your land. Now, even though he had the right, he in doing what he legally had the right to do, rubbed people the wrong way. I mean, you're going to take land from one of the most known and celebrated privates, Joseph Plum Martin. So maybe he made a mistake on that, but he was still, you know, if you want to look at his character, even after the British looted and destroyed and took everything out of his bookstore, he had inventory of it, and he actually paid the people the bills that he owed back to London, where he ordered them from. So like anybody, there's good good things that people do and sometimes bad things that happen. And I think Joseph Plum Martin was probably not a good call on his part because he was so well known. But on October 22nd, 1806, Henry Knox was eating dinner and he accidentally swallowed a chicken bone, which caused an infection and died 3 nights later on October 25th at the age of 56. I've read that it got caught in his throat and it caused a throat infection. And I've also seen that he swallowed it into his stomach, which caused an infection. Either way, he died from, a chicken bone. And here's another part where people will make fun. Well, he was so big and fat, he just ate the whole chicken and the bone. See, I just think that's unnecessary. You have a war hero, a guy that was critically important in the formation of keeping the war going on. And here they are talking about him eating a whole chicken. I just don't get it. But that's for them to do, not us. And ironically, George Washington also would have an infection of the throat that would eventually take his life. And these men fought, were shot at, could have been killed in so many countless ways. And yet both died from infections. It's just one of those weird things. What happened to his wife?
So his wife, Lucy, after his death, they had some debts that had been mounting from Henry's business venture. So she ended up having to sell much of their land that he had acquired. They had three children, two sons and a daughter. And the daughter, who was also named Lucy, had a son named Henry Thatcher, who would become an admiral in the Navy during the Civil War.
Wow. So carry on the tradition of being in the war at a high position. Not quite as high as Henry Knox. But, yeah, pretty amazing. So we have now reached the part of the show called Lesser Known, Fun, or Interesting Facts. So here we go. So we have mentioned that Henry Knox was present or attended many famous historical events. Right now, I'm going to go through some of them with you. Knox participated in nearly every significant battle in the Revolutionary War. He oversaw and crossed the Delaware River with Washington and brilliantly commanded the artillery at the ensuing Battle of Trenton. Washington, again impressed by his performance, recommended Knox's promotion to Brigadier General. He later participated in the battles of Princeton, Brandywine, Germantown, and Monmouth. In 1780, this is an incredible story. It's just every rabbit hole, so I won't get too deep. But in 1780, Henry Knox sat on the court-martial of Major John Andre. That name ring a bell? John Andre was the British officer who had conspired with Benedict Arnold to gain British control of West Point. Knox further contributed to the Patriot cause by placing the artillery for Washington during the victorious siege of Yorktown, and soon after rose to the rank of Major General.
You might know that Fort Knox is named after Henry Knox. Probably that's most people's exposure to the name Knox.
And, hey, you know, I didn't even think of this, but we have two German shepherds. One of our German shepherds, we named him Knox because of Henry Knox.
There are 9 cities and counties named after Knox. And George Washington and Henry Knox became very close friends. Washington relied on him completely during the Revolution. As we heard earlier, he was involved in almost every major battle in some way.
So, I mean, when you read some of the letters that Washington and Knox wrote back to each other, and some of the orders that Washington gave, he relied on Henry Knox so much. In fact, I think Knox might have been the most heavily relied upon person that George Washington needed, just so time after time after time. So anyway, there you have the story of the Knox expedition and how important Henry Knox was. And I really hope that you share this with people because I think it's just an incredible story. It's a story that allowed us to continue the war, and it made a huge impact. It might have been the most important determining factor in the formation of the United States. I also want to give you a sneak peek into my next bonus episode, as it came from a faithful listener, and his name is Shane. Shane is a sergeant in the 2nd Continental Marines, and he asked to learn more about John Paul Jones. Shane, thank you so much for your service. And as requested, my next bonus episode, I will be talking about the father of the American Navy, as John Paul Jones is commonly called. Jones really had an incredible life, one filled with triumphs and some pretty bad accusations and some pretty massive issues. But watch out for the next bonus episode to learn all about him. And thanks so much, Shane, for emailing me with your request that I'm going to honor, and I'll get that out as soon as I can. Please consider doing a review of the podcast if you have a minute, because that's all the time it takes. And the more reviews it receives, the easier it is for people to find it. And if you want to help out financially, you can become a monthly supporter or make a one-time donation. You can do this at patriotpowerpodcast.com and click on Support Podcast. Lastly, please check out the show notes for this episode and all previous episodes. I want you to enjoy the videos, links, and book recommendations that are neatly organized and compiled for you. It's just an amazing bunch of resources prepared just for you.
Thanks for listening, and hope that you tune in next time with us here at the Patriot Power Podcast. Make sure that you hit subscribe so you'll get notified when our new episodes are available for you. And we hope that you check out our websites, which include our show notes, links, documents, and more at patriotpowerpodcast.com or ilovegeorgewashington.com. Until next time, hope that you and your family have a blessed week. And remember, be safe and tell a veteran thanks for their service.